Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series of Bruegel, the Brussels-based economics think tank. My name is Mariam Demirtis, and I'm the Deputy Director at Bruegel. And with me today, I have two distinguished guests, Ayhan Kose. Hi, Ayhan, how are you?
Thank you.
Ayhan is the Chief Economist and Director at Prospects Group at the World Bank. And joining him this afternoon is Gregory Claes, who is a Senior Fellow here at Bruegel. Hi, Gregory, good to have you back.
Hello.
The topic of today's conversation is something that I'm afraid is of great interest to everybody, and it has to do with the macro outlook, both on the growth side as well as on the inflation, something that, of course, we haven't seen rates of inflation of quite so high for a long time. And, you know, it affects every single consumer. The World Bank has produced a very interesting report on these two issues, and that's why we have the pleasure of inviting Ayhan to join us this afternoon. Ayhan, could you give us the gist of your report when it comes to the growth prospects globally?
Thank you, Maria, and thank you for inviting me. Basically, when you look around the world, you see growth is slowing. There's a context to this. We have a rapid, highly synchronous policy tightening to contain inflation. You see financial conditions worsening. You see global demand is weakening. And of course, when you look at the three major engines of the global economy, the United States, Euro area, and China, they are all expected to experience a protracted period of weakness. The U.S. economy, in fact, in the first half of this year, contracted and facing a historically rapid pace of monetary policy tightening. When you look at euro area, activity is weakening rapidly because of soaring energy prices. And this is being compounded by rising borrowing costs. The euro area is expected to contract next year. And then you have China is slowing sharply this year because of the COVID-related disruptions and ongoing stress in the property sector. When you put all of these things together, what do you see? You see global economy is slowing at a pace sharper than it did slow prior to previous global recessions. So the latest study looks at recent developments, looks at policy responses today and what happened prior to the previous global recessions, and then examines three distinct scenarios about the possible paths for the global economy going forward. Unfortunately, one of these scenarios is about a global recession next year. So let me stop there.
Yeah. So we'll come back to some of the things, actually, they're very interesting, and maybe the scenarios and how to describe them. But let me just turn to you, Gregory, and perhaps zoom in a little bit on the euro area where we all live, well, at least both of us live. You heard Ayhan actually talk about a recession for next year. The ECB is not forecasting a recession, is it? I think 0.9, the latest forecast, right?
Yeah, the main forecast of the ECB is still positive. However, they also have like a downside forecast, an alternative forecast, which is an adverse scenario forecast. And to be honest, our adverse scenario forecast is starting to materialize because one of the main assumptions that they have in this adverse scenario is a cutoff of Russian gas, which is materializing as we speak. Therefore, all the bad scenario are becoming the main scenario. And therefore, the scenario of the ECB, which is the bad one, is at minus 0.9. And if you look at other institutions, OECD, the IMF, etc., everybody is revising its own forecast towards almost zero or even negative growth for the euro area next year.
But can I zoom in a little bit, if I may, because there are big differences, and we'll come to the inflation as well. But for the moment on the growth, I mean, there are pockets of the EU that are actually hit much harder than others. Are they correlated with the geography, if I may call it this way, so closer to the source of the shock, then you have a greater impact of the downside?
Yeah, definitely. Of course, the euro area is made of countries that are very much interrelated. So if one big country like Germany suffers, everybody will suffer. But it's true that they have still different characteristics. They still have very different energy mix. Of course, if you're Estonia or if you're Spain or France, you're going to be affected in a very different way by the Russian gas cutoff. So yes, some country, in particular in Eastern Europe, will suffer more. Actually, Poland, for instance, was already contracting in Q2, while there were still countries that had quite positive growth in Q2 this year.
Yeah, this is a global crisis that has got a very specific characteristic, and that is that it is followed by inflation. And this is very different to the previous ones we've seen in the past 15 years or so. where the crises were contractionary, right, Ayhan? And Chairman Powell actually talked about inflation as a global phenomenon. So I think the whole world is facing that. But there are important differences between countries, right? And they are felt differently. Don't you agree, Ayhan?
Of course. When you look at the inflation and what explains inflation around the world, increasingly global factors are becoming more important. What happened after the pandemic, there were very serious supply shocks, along with, of course, this pent-up demand unleashed. And both on the supply side and demand side, you had these pressures pushing prices upwards. And what we saw, collapse of inflation during the pandemic. After that, you had this basically pent-up demand in 2021 that added inflationary pressures. And then on the commodity side, you had these shocks associated with energy prices. And of course, the Russian invasion of Ukraine added additional pressure. So all in all, where we are now, we have at the global level, inflation is running at almost three-decade high. In emerging developing economies, it's running at 14-year high. And in advanced economies, they're four-decades high. What is important when you look at this combination, the high inflation and weak growth, of course, reminds us the 1970s and early 1980s, the stagflation. And the risk of stagflation is much higher today when you think about where we were 6 months ago. So that complicates the policy picture and puts policymakers in a corner. On the one hand, you expect policymakers to respond to slowing activity by providing accommodation. But since inflation is on the rise and inflation expectations creeping up, they have no choice but rapidly withdraw the existing support measures they put in. And of course, central banks around the world have been doing that.
Yeah, we need to zoom in a little bit on this policy reaction and sort of the difficult position that central banks and actually other policymakers are also finding themselves right now. And Gregory, you know, again, if I may zoom in again on the euro area, again, not one picture, right? I mean, the Netherlands is facing, I heard yesterday, 17% inflation. Some Baltic countries have in excess of 20% inflation. Can you remind us what the ECB forecasts are for this year and next year?
The ECB forecast, at least their main forecast, is at 5.5% for 2023, even though they might already be outdated and go above 6%. For instance, the ECB is already above 6%. And it's true that something that is very new compared to what happened, since, let's say, the global financial crisis, is that we have a lot of heterogeneity in inflation. Inflation is around 5-6% in France, in Malta, and as you said, 27% in Estonia. So numbers for the Netherlands are a bit misleading. Actually, I was looking into that yesterday, and it's because they applied energy prices to all households, even though not all of them may be affected by the current increase in energy. So there are still some problems at the statistical level that might blur the picture sometimes, but still this image of huge heterogeneity is very important, and it's going to make, obviously, the job of the ECB much more difficult.
No, that's right. So, you know, I wanted to sort of zoom in a little bit. It is true that, you know, most central banks now are increasing interest rates. Even in Japan, I think now we're seeing inflation, right? But even though, you know, you would call it a synchronous increase of interest rates, the pace at which we're doing it is very different. Of course, that is explaining a little bit, at least the divergence of currencies. But let's zoom in a little bit and see how far can policy, monetary policy, go in terms of addressing the problem of inflation, given, as you both described, is a very specific nature. Ayhan?
The simple answer, Maria, monetary policy has to go as far as it has to go to contain inflationary pressures. And I think central bankers around the world have a very good sense of their mandates, and they are reacting accordingly. Of course, this reaction could have been earlier, but this Russian invasion of Ukraine changed the dynamics on the supply side dramatically and amplified the inflation problem pretty much for everyone. Now, the challenge with this synchronous policy response is how it is being felt in different countries. Different countries have different challenges when it comes to inflation. You can compare euro area versus the United States. In the US, you really have labor market tightness. Energy prices are, of course, affected by what's going on in the rest of the world. But in the case of euro area, the big challenge centers around the issue of energy. Having said that, when central banks increase interest rates in tandem, the given we already discussed, inflation is increasingly global. The fact that one of them, one major central bank like the Fed, increased interest rates, it helps reduce inflationary pressures at the global level. So they are doing it in tandem, of course, will help put inflation down, hopefully faster than if some of them did alone. But at the same time, what happens is that through the exchange rate channel, there is transmission of inflation from one country to another. Think of the US increasing interest rates, and then you have emerging developed economies, of course, other advanced economies, their currency is depreciating. So they are importing inflation because their currency is depreciating. And the third important channel, when we think about how inflation monetary policy nexus in play at the global level, how increasing interest rates tighten financial conditions, and how these financial spillovers are so dominant nowadays. We saw what happened last week in the UK, how the challenges in UK had repercussions in other advanced economy financial markets. So the big question going forward, whether central banks contain inflation without tightening financial conditions more than they want, and without slowing the economy, more than they want. In a sense, whether they can do this without overshooting.
Yeah. That's exactly the number one question. I would like to come back to, Ihan, to your point about the appreciating dollar and what this does to financial conditions, and particularly to the developed world, dollar-denominated debts for these countries. But let me just stay with inflation for a minute. And Gregory, come back to you. I mean, I think there is a sense in the euro area that the ECB has been late in sort of waking up to actually doing something for inflation. We heard President Lagarde the other day telling us that inflation is about 60% supply-driven, as Ihan said, 40% demand-driven, and therefore subject to the effects of monetary policy. So it goes back to the issue that it's not really free monetary policy to affect and bring down inflation given its composition. So my question to you, and this is a very important one, because the effects of monetary policy will not be felt for another 18 months or so. Even though the ECB has been late to come in, isn't there a chance, isn't there a risk that by changing interest rates now, and actually as fast as they've announced that they're going to increase them, that this will stall growth at a time when perhaps the inflationary shock will have dissipated?
No, that's indeed a risk. And to be honest, I think people are a bit tough with the ECB. If you think about it, the Fed only started to raise interest rate in March. The ECB started in July. And the situation, as Ellen said, are very different. On one side of the Atlantic in the US, the labor market is very tight. We have clear overheating. We have had a lot of fiscal stimulus, etc. While in Europe, the situation is different. The labor market is less tight. We don't see any wage peril. The main indicator for inflation expectation have been relatively stable, et cetera, et cetera. So in that sense, it was normal for the ECB to wait a bit more than the US. And in my view, the terminal rate should be also lower because the ECB needs a bit less tightening than in the US. Whether they are doing actually too much is actually a good question. Because as you said, the effect of monetary policy are very much lagged. Generally, we say that it takes at least 1 year to arrive. And basically, this is at the moment where we expect to see a recession in Europe. So maybe it was almost too late to raise interest rate in Europe. But actually, I'm thinking that something that Ellen said before is very important, is the fact that there was an appreciation of the dollar, and that basically for other central banks in the world, and including in Europe, it was difficult not to act because actually in Europe, the main source of inflation is coming from energy and in particular from high gas prices. But with the dollar appreciating by like 20% since mid-2021, it also means that it increased imported inflation for Europe. And I think it played an important role in the ECB decision to increase and to increase by a lot in July and in September, because they were really afraid of that. So I think the coordination question that was discussed before by Ian, I think is very important, because if the Fed tightened too much, in the end, it will force other zones that maybe need less tightening to over-tighten. And I think that's the big danger that we face at the moment.
My sense is that the ECB is not paying attention to the exchange rates, but
that's what they say, obviously.
That's what they say. And in fact, they have gotten it wrong previously when it comes down to this. But the point, of course, is well taken that there is a the exchange rate channel that feeds into inflation, which is Ayhan's point, which affects actually the prime objective of inflation. So and let me just then take over from this point on the coordination need and ask you the question as I lead into the what it means for the developed world, if it's possible to coordinate globally monetary policy, given that the source of the shock is very different and it's actually felt very differently across countries. So what's your view, Ayhan?
Maria, I think this is a critical question, especially during the next week we will have IMF World Bank annual meetings. The global community will focus on these issues. Now, we know that in most cases, coordination is a good thing. If you have a global problem, you try to solve that with a global solution. But really, central banks don't have a good system to coordinate their policies. It's not like they're going to say, oh, you increase this much, I increase that much interest rates to contain inflation. Different countries have different challenges, different drivers of inflation. They need to adjust their policies accordingly. Well, what is important here, countries take into account what is going on in the rest of the world much more seriously today than they did in the past, given the kind of the global integration we have and how the forces of inflation are increasingly becoming in global nature. So the central banks are getting together every other month in Basel, discussing issues. They are discussing issues at the Finance Stability Board. It's going to be important to intensify these discussions. And in fact, to think about the fact that they are increasing interest rates in tandem, tightening financial conditions, what will happen if there is a market event? And that market event might happen in an emerging market economy, that market event that can happen in an advanced economy, in an environment, monetary policy is just working in one direction, and that direction is towards tightening financial conditions. So I think that there is no explicit policy coordination, but there is an urgency to take into account the consequences of tightening financial conditions at the global level and how that will affect their own economies. So there are spillovers and there are spillbacks associated with monetary policy decisions. And this is the type of, I think tightening cycle, the first time we are seeing after 40 years in unison increases in interest rates, central banks need to be very mindful of their actions, how these actions reverberate around the world and how things happen in the rest of the world, and they affect their own economies.
If there is one thing we learned from what happened to the UK 10 days ago, so actually the length of most of last week, is that the central bank, the Bank of England, found itself in a rather awkward position, right, where it had to, so it's increasing interest rates because, as you say, it's increasing its the need to control inflation is absolutely important. I think there are 10% now inflation in the UK. But at the same time, they had to continue buying government bonds to try and calm down the markets for financial stability purposes. So it's as though they were pushing on the brake and accelerating at the same time, right? So this of course, makes it even more awkward. And if I may come to you, Gregory, how do you view this? You know, I have talked about global coordination. How do you view the issue of coordination within policies, especially when it comes to the euro area?
Yeah, I think what we saw in the UK is a classical case of financial dominance, in the sense that the Bank of England was constrained in its action by what was happening in financial market, and basically they could not let long-term gilt go up by a lot, because otherwise it could create a mess in the repo market, because gilt played an important role as collateral. So basically they were already announcing that they were going to do QT, so quantitative tightening, and use their balance sheet, but they had, on the contrary, to do the opposite. However, whether that constitutes a break and at the same time they were increasing rate, so whether they do two things that are incompatible, I'm not that sure, actually, because basically you can control the whole yield curve, because what matters for the economy is the whole yield curve, and you don't want the long-term part of the yield curve to increase too quickly. So in that sense, you might increase the short-term end because you want to tighten monetary policy, but at the same time, you don't want long-term rates to increase tremendously. So in that sense, I don't see those two as totally incompatible. They are kind of complementary. And in the euro area, we might have to do the same. And that's why the ECB introduced a new tool in July, the TIP, because they want to be able to increase short-term rates, but at the same time, they don't want spread to explode. So that's why they have two different tools. So if we have two different objectives, and I think those two objectives are not totally incompatible, you can have two different tools to deal with them.
Well, I mean, you know, that of course is a very big discussion. I mean, it has to how incompatible they are, but there are two frictions between the two. I remember the interest rate was used also for monetary policy purposes, which is basically at the short end of the curve. But I mean, obviously, it's true what you say. To the extent that the buying of the debt affects the long term of the yield curve, then of course it is much more a financial stability issue. But events will prove which part of the curve we can operate at, right? Okay, I don't want to go too deep into the euro areas because that is, of course, very specific. We have a very specific setup in the EU, which is quite different. And come back a little bit to the global scenario, if I may turn to you back, I hand here. And that is really, if I may zoom in a little bit on the dollar appreciate, and how do you see that to the extent that monetary policies across the world, despite the best intentions, are not synchronized or they don't move at the same pace? What kind of threat does that pose to the developed world and to indebtedness, in particular for those that are really exposed to the dollar debt?
So with the appreciation of dollar, of course, cost of borrowing increases. If you have elevated debt levels, if you have dollar-denominated debt, this period poses unique challenges when you think about how much debt the global economy, especially emerging market developing economies, accumulated since 2010. We saw the largest, fastest, and the most synchronized debt accumulation pretty much in history over the past decade by emerging market developing economies. Pandemic did not help. Pandemic added quite a bit of, you know, additional debt for obvious reasons, and these reasons were justified. Now, what is happening when you have this such a large volume of debt? You need to create growth, and you need to make sure, you know, you can pay back so the borrowing costs are low. Of course, what's going on, growth is increasingly becoming elusive. The growth numbers are being downgraded every month. And you have the very serious challenge of rapidly increasing interest rates. A number of low-income countries, frontier market economies, are already in debt distress or this very high likelihood of falling into debt distress, meaning that they are going to have very serious difficulties in rolling over debt obligations, liabilities they have. Now, when you look at what happened, last time we had this type of scenario in the early 1980s, when interest rates increased around the world, and that triggered the global recession in 1982, it also triggered the Latin American debt crisis. In the 1980s, we had more than 40 debt crises. And that number in one decade is larger than all the kind of the debt crisis we had. So the total number of debt crises we had is still smaller than the number we had in the 1980s. So this is a single most important challenge for emerging developing economies, primarily because we don't have a robust debt restructuring mechanism. Global community has made good progress with the common framework, but it's still not there. If we have a string of debt crises next year, we will have difficulty in addressing them. And the fact that we were not able to address these debt crises in the 1980s in a timely fashion translated into that decade becoming a lost decade for Latin America, for many developing economies. In the context of course, low-income countries, it was an absolute disaster because the problems that started in the 1980s extended all the way to early 2000s when the global community decided to push the HIPIC initiative and basically gave debt relief.
Apart from monetary policy, there is also other policies that are taking place. Certainly in the euro area, we know of the very extensive fiscal measures that individual countries have taken. They are typically redistributive policies to support, actually, the energy bill, if I may call it this way. And there are other measures that we are discussing in Europe, aren't we, Gregory? You know, I'm thinking of the energy cap, things that I got, you know, address directly the problem, which is on the energy side. So my question to both of you, and I start with you, Gregory, is whether there is, given your assessment of the other policies that are we putting in place, is there still a possibility of a soft landing in the global economy? And I'll start with Gregory.
About the EU itself, I think whether we manage to survive the winter depends mainly on two external factors. Actually, is that we the first one is, of course, gas coming from Russia. And the second one is actually temperature. If we had a very tough winter, it's going to be difficult for Europe. So we have like external factors that we cannot really forecast. However, there are also like policy decisions that needs to be made. And depending on the decisions that we take, we can have like a soft recession or a catastrophic recession. And I have to say, the way we deal with the issue of the energy crisis, and in particular, if we manage, for instance, to reduce our consumption of energy and in gas in particular, if also we manage to collaborate between European countries in order to help the ones that have more problems than others, etc., in that case, it could be easier for us. Also, the price of gas could be lower if we coordinate and if we collaborate. And therefore, inflation will be lower, and therefore maybe the ECB will have to tighten less. So actually, I still think that we still have some policy lever in our hands, and we can try to make this recession, a recession seems almost inevitable at this point, but we can soften it by having the right policies, in my view.
But it will require a substantive, reduction in energy demand. So basically, you know,
yes,
we are told by the European Commission to keep our heating at 19 degrees. I wonder if we'll manage that. The other thing, of course, which is important for the EU, is that I think this time, this winter is probably catered for. But next winter, it's not so obvious, given, of course, that there will not be any Russian gas anymore. And you know, it's not so easy to substitute, given that there is infrastructure bottlenecks. So policy will have to be very closely calibrated, right, Gregory?
Exactly.
And Ihan, what about the rest of the world? Because the ability of the EU to buy energy, and by ability, I mean, we paid a very high price for it, but we did pay a high price for it, has actually, you know, made it a lot more difficult for other countries across the world to cover their energy needs. So, you know, can they avoid a recession, and what kind of policies would they have to put in place, given also the appreciation of the dollar?
Thank you, Maria. You raise a very important point. The fact that, of course, European Union is solving its problems critical, and they should do everything in their power to do so. But that has repercussions for the rest of the world. And when you look at the global economy, of course, people focus on the global recession for obvious reasons, but that pushes the debate to be a binary debate in the sense that whether you will have a global recession or not have a global recession, or whether you will have a soft landing or not outright global recession. The reality is global economy will slow markedly next year. And that has huge consequences for advanced economies, for emerging market developing economies. I think we will see a much sharper slowdown in advanced economies than emerging market developing economies. The arithmetic when it comes to global economy is very clear. When you think about the US, Euro area and China, they account for more than 50% of global output and more than 60% of global growth. And these three engines of the global economy have been losing steam. And in all likelihood, that will continue. Policies can help. But given the fundamental problem of inflation, they have to be complementary. They have to be consistent. Fiscal policy should not undermine monetary policy. So broad-based fiscal accommodation is not in the cards. Fiscal accommodation, if any, has to be targeted, well-defined, range-bound, and time-bound. In the context of emerging market developing economies, they need to think about how they are going to ensure fiscal sustainability while they are confronting these adverse shocks coming from the rest of the world, including, of course, tightening financial conditions. They need to provide targeted relief to vulnerable households. And of course, they need to have a medium-term fiscal framework. We spent a lot of time on monetary policy and fiscal policy. They have critical roles to play, but there are some policies on the supply side. And we need to also think about those policies in the context of Europe, this desperate search to bring more natural gas to Europe is to strengthen the supply side. But the broader context, there is need to accelerate the transition to low carbon energy sources. And of course, as Europe has been doing, Maria, you alluded to, think how you can make energy consumption more efficient. And there is need to think about the tightness in labor markets, how we can overcome that tightness in labor markets, which is a big problem in the US, but it is also an issue other parts of the world and in some countries in the European Union. And then there is this overall challenge when you think about supply disruptions in the context of global value chains. And the fact that, you know, we have these COVID outbreaks in China that has implications for the global economy, have the supply chains operating. And there is this, you know, the threat of fragmentation of global trade networks, investment networks. And these types of threats are also inflationary over the medium and long term. So my hope is that global community is going to renew its commitment to rule-based international order and understand that this is the type of order that also actually helps ensure price stability.
It's as long as you've moved on to sort of the longer term implications of the current of the risk of a recession this year, but also of the broader crisis, the energy crisis that we are witnessing. So, Gregory, what is your view on this? Are there any substantive risks as we move forward, which are a little bit more longer term as a result of coming into a recession right now, but also as a result of the geopolitical divisions, the geopolitical camps, if I may call it this way, that the energy shock has created?
It's true that we discuss only about short-term risk, short-term solution, diversify away from Russia, etc. But we need really to think, in particular as far as energy is concerned, about the long term. Because actually, even if we manage to stabilize or to make the price of gas go down in the next few months, it will still be high relative to the normal, relative to what happened before. And therefore, we need to have like long-term solution. Finding new suppliers of LNG is good, but as you said, it means that we are taking this LNG from someone else. So we need to have like long-term solution for that. Either we increase the production of LNG, but this is not simple and it will take years. Or, and actually it would be even better, and Ayan actually mentioned that, I think we need to accelerate the transition toward renewables and no fossil fuel energy because that's the only solution to have lower prices of energy in Europe.
If I may attempt to summarize, and please correct me and tell me what your summary would be, I see inflation becoming progressively tighter, at least for the next 6 months or so. I see, and in fact, to Ayan's point of fiscal policy being more targeted so that it is redistributive, and a call from both of you for accelerating the green transition. Ayan, is this a good summary or how would you modify it?
It's a good summary, Maria. I think we need to internalize the fact that yes, we did experience once-in-a-century event in 2020. That was, in every sense of the word, dramatic. But now we are confronting a problem we had last time 40 years ago. When we confronted this problem 40 years ago, we ended up with a global recession. We did reduce inflation, but the cost was very high. And when we think about global recessions, you look what happened since 1970. In every decade, there was one global recession. And when you have a global recession, that means per capita income contracts. And that has huge consequences for growth, poverty, inequality, however you look at it. Now, there is a possibility we might have the second global recession in one decade. The first one, of course, was 2020, that had huge negative impact on growth prospects push down potential growth because of the losses associated with investment and human capital. Another global recession in 2023 would deepen those losses and extend in an environment we really have desperate need for intelligent growth and sustainable growth. So the question for policymakers, whether they can advantage of this crisis and on the one hand, control inflation intelligently, and on the other hand, accelerate energy transition and come out of this crisis in a way that they have stronger economies, not weaker.
Grigory?
No, very good summary. To come back to policy, I agree, fiscal need to be finely calibrated. I think it's very important. And I think actually that's what we are seeing. We are really seeing some redistributive fiscal policy. But I have to say, to be honest, I think monetary policy need also now to be finely calibrated after all those huge hikes that we have seen, which were logical to restore the credibility of central banks, and which were logical to go from very expansionary to neutral. I think now in some part of the world, in particular in the US, we are maybe going from neutral to restrictive. And therefore, maybe the time of huge 75 basis point or 100 basis point hike might be over. And that maybe now central banks, in particular in the US, need to be a bit more gradual. Also, given the effects that we have discussed and the need for coordination and the impact that high interest rate and an appreciation of the dollar have on the rest of the world.
Indeed. Well, I think we are closely coming to the end of our episode. I think there is a lot of interesting points here. I am particularly worried about what I have said on the, so that, you know, two global recessions in the space of 2 years, effectively, and how that is going to have, if I understand you correctly, has scarring effects, particularly for the most vulnerable across the world. And I take both your messages, or rather the message of both of you, of the need for more cooperation, coordination, in order to try and alleviate at least the biggest impact of this two recessions. Again, thank you very much, both of you, for joining us this afternoon. It's been tremendously interesting to listen to you. I thank our listeners for taking the time to listen to our podcast this afternoon. And you can find all our writings at the webpage of Bruegel at www.bruegel.org. That's all we have time for today. See you next time. Bye.
Bye.